everyone, and welcome. This is episode 333 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, joined by Ryan and Paul, and we're all very confused because a Minnesota team is not blowing a game seven as we speak this, or a must-win situation. I say that with 2 minutes left in this game seven between the Nuggets and the T-Wolves, but we'll see what happens.
Make it happen.
Yeah, there we go. I don't know. Maybe
their best player could always randomly break his hand.
That's true. That has happened today, in fact. So sorry, Knicks. But other than that, weekend check-in, folks. How are we doing?
Oh man. Oh, you go first, Ryan. I'm going to take a nap.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I saw the Decemberists last night, Paul. It was quite good.
Oh, cool. Good.
It's a very good show, this tour. I don't know if they were already in Chicago or they're headed to Chicago at some point.
They're next. I'm seeing them on Tuesday. So.
Oh, you are seeing them on Tuesday. Okay. Okay. Enjoy. I won't spoil too much for you. It is a very, very entertaining show, and I had lots and lots of fun.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. I had nothing but soccer games outside in the 85-degree heat. And I just want to go to sleep. That's all I want to do. And some other things popped up that I should not have done and should have slept instead. And yeah, so that's all. I got to rest up for Tuesday because I'm going to be tired out that day too.
Is that a Salt Shed show?
It is.
Okay. So they're moving over from where we saw them, which was the Chicago Theater, which about the same size, I would imagine. So, okay.
Yeah, I think the Salt Shed might even be a little bigger.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. They say the capacity in that is much lower than it really seems like when you're in the place and you're looking around. It sure seems like a lot more than like 4,000 people, but they claim it's that. So I don't know. But yeah, I actually had three different concerts this week. I saw Portugal the Man on Tuesday, and then nice. I went with Steve and saw a Grateful Dead cover band. Well, the guy used to actually be the keyboardist for the Jerry Garcia band. So went and saw that on Thursday night at the Cooperage in Bayview here. And all three were very, very, very good shows. But nice. It's a little early. Like, this is not summer yet. It's not like concert time, but these three concerts happen to be scheduled this way. So yeah, I'm not quite ready for this. I'm not in playing shape that way. Yep.
The Salt Shed and the Chicago Theater have the exact same number of seats. So no change at all.
All right. Well, we'll get into a regular season summer shape as we get into this, right? It's like spring training for summer. So mm-hmm. I have faith in you guys that we'll get up to speed with the concert stuff. So, all right. Brewers also, you know, barreling towards Memorial Day where things start to matter a little bit more, but we'll talk about how the last week has shaken out. But first, a reminder, as always, you can become a patron. Go to patreon.com/MKETailgate. And for $2 a month, you get question priority both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. $5 a month gets you that perk plus the exclusive content, the Minor League Extra with Ryan and Spencer Michaelis, and the reporting as eligible mini pod. Even if you're not a patron, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you are hearing this right now. Give us a 5-star review to help us out that way. That's totally free. And while you're there, be sure to hit the subscribe or follow button to make sure you never miss an episode. So, you know, we were talking last week, the Brewers were in the midst of capping off a series win over the Cardinals. They won 3 of 4 over the Cardinals that weekend. And then they extended that successful homestand, taking 2 of 3 from the Pirates before embarking on their longest road trip of the season, the dreaded 9-game, 10-day road trips that it's going to take them through Houston, Miami, and Boston before returning home for Memorial Day against Cret Council and the Cubs. So they finished the first leg of that trip. They lost 2 of 3 in Houston, reminding us all how much we hate the cheap Crawford box home runs. It was the Brewers' first, I think, series in Houston since, 2019, I thought I saw. So it's been a while. Still hate that stupid stadium. At least they don't have Tells Hill anymore. The Astros have been hot, though. They won 9 of their last 11 now after starting 12-24. So bad time to catch the Astros, but The Brewers offense has continued to battle most of those games. They've scored four runs in each game over the weekend. They are third in baseball in runs scored. They are still averaging 5.11 runs per game. They're also ranking highly in WRC plus at 118, or 18% better than league average. Even the most optimistic of us probably couldn't have been expecting the offense to be this good. So let's talk about sustainability. We do have some Patreon questions on that, but just first of all, Ryan, just generalities, like, we keep waiting for the bottom to kind of fall out on this and they keep scoring runs.
Yeah, it really has been something to watch, and it's like a different person all the time. They've gone through a bunch of different people who've gotten hot and then have cooled off, and or also injured. Like Christian Yelich was blazing hot to start and then got hurt. Bryce Turang got hot and then cooled off significantly over like the last week, but then kind of over the weekend seemed to find it a little bit again. I don't have the exact numbers for over the weekend, but I think he had a three-hit day on Sunday, so yep, with a double in there, so he's been a little bit better, but they've kind of had people taking turns. The consistent guy throughout all of this really has been William Contreras, who's basically putting up MVP level numbers here. Like, he is putting up an MVP caliber performance so far. Mm-hmm. I don't know, 179 OPS plus. He just had his, so he didn't get on base on Sunday for the first time in, was it 26 games? So he had his 25 game on base streak snapped. And I don't think a 179, we should expect that to continue. But I think he's going to continue to be a very, very good hitter. As long as they can find him some time to, like, get him a few more days off. That is one of my big concerns. Is it's not even necessarily, like, he has to, like, take the day off. I just don't have him catching quite as much as he has been. I was running the numbers on this, and last year, I think it was, he caught, like, 109 games and played, like, 132 total. And right now he's on pace to catch like 130 games and play in 162. So that doesn't seem overly sustainable. And like that seems like something that's just going to grind him down. And the thing is, you can just give him a lot more, you know, DH days and just let Gary Sanchez, who's now up to a 131 OPS plus and is doing really well in his own right, give him more time behind the dish, even if it's, you know, I think they've been trying to get him mostly in there against left-handed pitching, but he can also hit right-handed pitching reasonably well, and he has power. So it's fine. Get him in there more.
Yeah, he's fourth on the team in home runs, so there's no reason not to be doing that. Are the Contreras, does Wilson have a history of, like, wanting to catch every game? Is that a thing? Because, you know, Yadi always wanted to be out there every single day.
The guy I think of is Sal Perez. Like, he is a maniac that way. He wants to be behind the dish every day, too.
And, you know, coaches have to not let that happen. But, yeah, I agree with that. But he seems to be... Contreras is always at the pop in his bat. It's just a matter of getting the ball up in the air. And the projection on William Contreras was, if you do that, then you might have something truly special. And so sometimes those come true. That seems to be the case here. They haven't missed a beat without Hoskins, which is also amazing. The other person we should talk about as a highlight to the season so far is my stat page crashed. It's Joey Ortiz. Yeah. I don't have his number in front of me anymore. But Joey Ortiz is also like quietly their second best offensive player, and has really turned it on over the last couple weeks in particular too. So. He was kind of like Contreras. He hit the ball into the ground too much. But he did have good maximum exit velocity, and they seem to have been able to harness both of them at least early in the season here. So, as long as you believe that they've fixed some elevation issues, I think that this is probably pretty sustainable. And I think that's fair because they seem to be much more clever about their hitters this year. And I would go to Turang for that. Like, the Turang profile really just seems to be like, you're good at these things. Stop, like, don't hit home runs. Don't pull the ball ever. Just, like, stuff out. That works. I think that they are doing a much better job of playing to the strengths of their players than they have in the recent past. And this is what you get. This is better coaching, and it seems to be working.
Yeah, so to go back to your question about Wilson Contreras, The number one season as far as games was 138 with 544 plate appearances in 2018. So that's right. High, but I imagine there's also a number of DH days in there.
Yeah.
And so that's high-ish for a catcher, but it's not remarkable or anything. And then nothing else over 500 plate appearances or like 128 games. And again, I'm assuming there's some DH days in there for him because he's a good enough hitter to warrant it. So I don't know. It doesn't seem to be so much a thing for him. Like I said, the guy I think of is Sal Perez. Like Sal Perez is like psychotic about it and does not want to come out of the lineup. Well, I know he's often faded down the stretch because I've rostered him many a year, and like late in the year, he's, you know, it's like garbage late. So you got to be careful about that with catchers.
And Joey Ortiz is a 167 OPS plus now, so just a hair behind William Contreras.
Yeah, and Joey Ortiz, we have a question kind of coming up about that. It's really, really interesting. Exactly. We're still short enough sample size, and it still is leaning a little bit heavy on the left-handed stuff. I think our sample of right-handed plate appearances is going to have to get bigger, and we're going to have to see more of that for me to start to feel really, really good about it. But it sure does look like he has made some significant improvements off of where he was last year in terms of like the contact numbers and things like that. If you go to a Statcast page, you could see there's some significant improvements there. And the discipline really is like seems to have taken a step forward here. So all of these things, huge positives that way. Some of the other ones, I don't know. Well, let's get to this My Only Lemonade question.
Sure. Ortiz definitely has taken off since, you know, the Brewers, Matt Arnold, went the Moneyball route and just got rid of Oliver Dunn so Pat Murphy could stop playing him. But yes, My Only Lemonade. First Patreon question this week asking, as of Sunday morning, the Brewers have 4 position players on pace for at least 5 Fangraphs WAR. Their projected totals, Contreras 9.4 !! In parentheses, Bryce Terang 6.5, Willy Adames 5.8, and Joey Ortiz 5.0. Last year's 92 win team had only one player reached the 5 Fangraphs WAR total in Contreras. This seems significant. So, will these 4 Brewers keep above their 5 win pace? If not, who is most likely to drop off? Paul, what do you think?
So, I think Terang is probably the most likely to drop off just because he is so reliant on balls in play for offensive value. He does provide, like, one of the things that all of these players have in common is that they do have a very high floor because they all bring significant defensive value to the table to start off with. It's just a matter of projecting the sustainability of the offensive performances they put up so far. Terang, I think, is, you know, he gets a couple of bad BABIP weeks and his offensive profile could start to crash pretty hard. That's the risk when you have something like this. But I don't think it'll crash too hard. The approach he's taken seems to be working quite well. I don't think he's going to stay on a 6.5 pace, but stranger things have happened. Adames just seems to be playing like normal Willy Adames, so I'm pretty confident in that 5.8. That seems about right. It's a high Adames, but it's normal. And again, he's a good defensive player. And Ortiz is, I think, a little bit of an unknown, but I think he will meet that 5. And I actually think he'll exceed it a little bit, mostly because the big thing that's changed in his profile is his launch angle so far, which seems to be something they're concentrating on. And with the pop he does have, plus his launch angle, plus being a stud defensive player in his own right, I think he gets there. But Terang, I think, is the obvious answer there in terms of likely to crash.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Ortiz, it's too unknown. But I would guess the under on that and feel pretty good about that. And then the Contreras under is just easy to take because,
well, 9.4.
Right, 9.4. Like, that is MVP. But like, usually 9.4 wins above replacement is gonna win you an MVP award. Like, that's just how that generally tends to go. So yeah, that one I would, and I think you're 100% right on the Adames thing. 5.8 is sort of towards the high end of the range you would expect from him, but it's within that range. Like, that's not something that I would think is crazy in any way, shape, or form for him. So yeah, it kind of is Terang, just because it's hard to do what he's doing in terms of offense without hitting the ball hard, and he's not hitting the ball hard. So to be able to effectively spray the ball around, and like, you know, a couple of the balls that got through today were like, yeah, they were bouncers that got through the four hole, as as Dillard called them. So it was like, yeah, this is not exactly, you know, lighting the ball up and hitting it around the park. Whereas William Contreras was still, even on the day he didn't get on base, he drove one. I thought he was going to sneak another one out down that right field line going opposite field, and it just barely ended up in the glove. That would have, I think, either tied the game or would have put him up one in that inning when they were coming back. So one thing that has been really nice, James, you kind of mentioned this, they've been very frisky offensively. Like, they don't shut down, they just kind of keep going and keep coming at you, and they just really do not give in and give up. And in most games, even when they're getting beat, they still manage to put up runs and make it a competitive game down the stretch. They've been shut down, you know, really on the low end of the outcomes this year. So it's that has been nice to see too, because they're just kind of relentless with the bats.
On the topic of Joey Ortiz and WAR, I'm going to pull this one up real quick. Adam Post had a Patreon question asking who finishes the year with the higher WAR, Joey Ortiz or Corbin Burnes. On Fangraphs, Ortiz currently leads 1.4 to 1.0. I will mention Adam sent this in before Corbin Burnes went off for 11 strikeouts over six innings and only one run allowed on Sunday. But Paul, who you got in terms of this WAR race here?
So Corbin's great. There's nothing against Corbin, and Ortiz is very unknown still, and this might not stick, but I'm still going to go with Ortiz because he's banked a lot of wins already, and I will never bet on a pitcher to stay healthy for the whole season. So I will take Ortiz in a bit of an upset there, with all the caveats that Corbin is a very good pitcher, and if he stays healthy, he'll be like a Cy Young contender. But yeah, I'll take the position player most of the time if they're any in the ballpark on that contest.
So when I was looking at the rundown tonight, I saw this question and I went, oh my God, because I actually posted the same thing this afternoon before Adam, I swear, before I saw what you posted, I posted screen grabs of their Fangraphs WARs up to date and posted them on Twitter this afternoon during the game. So I did not, I don't know why that popped into my head at the same time, but I did not see your question. So as I said in that, I don't expect it to continue. I think Corbin is a pretty good bet. He has every incentive to be good, and you know, there's going to be adjustment. Joey Ortiz right now is getting, I'm sure, a lot of advanced scouting attention, and people are looking for how are we going to attack this guy. And I bet you some rough times are coming for him, you know, probably here relatively soon. But I think this is a lot more competitive than I think anybody would have put it at the beginning of the year. And it goes to show how these sorts of trades just, you can't even take for granted like that. Because the way we broke this down, and it of course makes perfect sense, we broke it down as, well, for this year, the advantage almost certainly lies on the side of the Orioles. But after that, the advantage obviously probably shifts strongly over to the Brewers side. You know, you honestly can't even say that much always, because baseball is weird, man. And it just, you can't, you notoriously can't predict it. So this is one of those things where you just kind of have to roll with it. And yeah, it would not be shocking if he did end up posting more wins. And then the calculus on that entire trade starts to look absolutely insane. Like it starts to get to absolutely ridiculous levels.
Yeah, at the same time, Joey Ortiz was massively blocked in the Orioles system, was not going to get anywhere. And DL Hall has been worth negative 0.3 WAR so far this year. So, hey, it's a wash, at least at that point. But DL Hall is working his way back. So we'll see what happens once he's back on the mound for the Brewers. Real quick, before we move on to other Patreon questions, Ryan, where do you think this team does end up being in terms of like runs per game and WRC plus? Is this sustainable through the rest of the season? Are we going to see a drop off? What do you think?
Yeah, 5-11 seems too high. It seems like it's right up there with the very, very best offenses. Like right now we're sandwiched in between the Dodgers, the Phillies, the Orioles, and the Guardians, oddly, are right up there with us. I think we're between, I'm not sure which is more surprising, the Brewers or the Guardians being up there in that group, because the Yankees then come next. So like none of those, like the Dodgers, Phillies, Orioles, Yankees, yeah, you would have picked those as like the best offensive teams in baseball. The Braves not being in that group and being kind of in the next group down would be a little bit surprising. So I think, yeah, the Brewers probably end up closer to, say, 4.5 than they do up over 5 for the course of the season. And that WRC plus is probably going to be more like 105 to 110 in all likelihood, which would still, if this ends up being like a 105 WRC plus offense over the course of the season, that is a massive, massive improvement off of their 92 last year. So it seems like the offense is going to be better this year than it was last year, and maybe by quite a bit. And there's still some guys on this roster. You look at that outfield. Look at the guys in the outfield, and you've got Sal Frelick, who after a couple of good games has fallen back down. He was at 92 coming into Sunday for OPS plus. Blake Perkins has really crashed and burned hard. He's down to 85, so 15% below the park adjusted league average. And Jackson Chourio's at 78, and all of those seem like they're not going to continue to get that bad of performance out of their outfield positions for the rest of the seasons. There's going to be other things that intervene here, and the players I think are going to get better. Frelick and Chourio both figure to get better. Guys like Mitchell are going to come back. Joey Weimer hopefully gets himself straightened out, and he comes back and puts up some good performance at some point. Something different is going to intervene here and improve like on those numbers. So I think probably solidly, but you know, modestly above average offensively for the season is what I'm projecting.
All right. Let's talk starting pitching. So, because that over the weekend struggled some against Houston's offense. You know, they're only 12th in runs per game, but we're 4th in WRC plus. So on the rebound, and as we mentioned, very hot lately. Freddy Peralta had another mediocre outing in a series of them on Friday, and Bryce Wilson managed to pitch himself out of a few jams on Saturday. The Brewers managed to squeak out that win, but then Colin Ray got rocked and struggled a bit on Sunday. So I guess, Paul, I'm going to keep asking this every week. Yeah. Any worries about how the pitching's going to hold up?
Yeah.
I guess specifically on this long trip and beyond.
Yes, they are fragile there. And the worst case. So first of all, they've still held up pretty well, mostly because their offense has just given them a lot of outs. Even when they've struggled, they've still managed to win some games. And the bullpen has still been, you know, pretty nails for the most part, with a couple of exceptions. But yeah, the starting pitching rotation does not look great. Yeah, Freddie has struggled. He's been basically an average pitcher over the course of the year. He has flashed normal Freddiness being good, but he has put up a couple of relative stinkers lately, and that's not good because they need him to carry this thing. Colin Ray, I think the worry with him is, while he is, I think, a perfectly serviceable pitcher against most lineups, if he does run into a lineup of studs, he is the kind of guy who is prone to get lit up by those studs. I would worry about like Dodgers series. I remember, I do need to sleep. We've had pitchers before go up against the Dodgers who throw in the 80s and low 90s and get lit up by them. And that's just the kind of thing you got there. Joe Ross has actually been pretty good, I think. His numbers wise hasn't been great, but he has been a bright spot. But like, is that going to continue? He's Joe Ross. So yeah, I think it would still be a good idea to add an arm to that thing because it's pretty fragile. And if you keep grinding out the bullpen, eventually the bullpen will also break. Didn't mention Gosser there. That, of course, is the big, you know, savior who's come along over the, you know, the last week. But the rest of it is not looking good.
Yeah. Also, we should mention Bryce Wilson, who's been.
And I said Gosser's name wrong, even though JR told me not to. So
Gasser.
It is Gasser. Sorry.
That'll take at least 3 years.
Yep, it will.
Yeah. It's, you know, any other team, he wouldn't be having this problem in San Diego. Everybody would have it correctly, but because we were all trained for 4 years on Josh, then yeah, we're all screwed on this one. So
Final Four legend, yeah. You know, once Robert makes a big postseason appearance, we'll get that right. Yeah.
But yeah, Bryce Wilson has been a bright spot too. And he has really, he struggled quite a bit in his start before this last start against Houston. He had his bad start against the Cardinals where he actually walked a bunch of batters, which is not generally what he does. So he had some struggles there and has had, you know, intermittent home run issues. But overall in the season, a 279 ERA, about a 2-1 strikeout to walk ratio. He's doing okay. The FIP number is not as good. FIP has him at 495, so significant regression expected there from him. But he's done a job so far, so you can't necessarily expect that to continue. It would be nice to get him out of the rotation, but there's going to have to be some other things that happen there for that to be possible. So there's going to have to be either trades or somebody coming back from injury. So we'll see. Yeah, this starting rotation is sort of being held together by, you know, I don't know, like a little bit of crazy glue. Like it's just kind of barely
sticky
hanging
stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Yes. By sticky stuff. Yep. We've been waiting all year for it to be the thing that undermines the team, and it hasn't happened so far. Because the offense has been so good and the bullpen has been, like Paul said, really, really good and has been nailed so far, that hasn't happened. But we have more than two-thirds of the season to go here. So we kind of have to be patient and wait for the next set of circumstances to come. At least they're out of that stupid ballpark now. And they're headed to a place where, like, it's very hard to hit home runs. So,
a cavernous, whatever they're calling, Lone Depot Park?
Lone Shark Stadium, yeah.
Lone Shark Stadium.
That's probably it.
Exactly. All right. Real quick, some injury updates, too, we should talk about. So, Rhys Hoskins, obviously, out with the hamstring injury. He's going to be out 2 to 4 weeks with that strained hamstring. Devin Williams apparently played catch for the first time on Sunday, still targeting the end of July for a return. Although the Brewers seem to be hoping for All-Star break, at least based on what they keep saying on the broadcast. So that's kind of interesting. And DL Hall, we mentioned, working his way back from the sprained knee, pitched well on Sunday. With the T-Rats, he was sitting 94-95, which was significant upgrade over where he was right before he landed on the injured list. The team's still kind of weighing if they want to stretch him back out or pitch him out of the bullpen when he returns. So I guess, Ryan, thoughts on any of those injury updates? Where do you think DL Hall lands once he's back?
Well, first off, we got lucky on Hoskins because everybody thought that was a knee. I think that happened Monday night, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't know what the result of that was.
Non-contact ACL for sure. Yeah. Like that looked bad.
Yeah. It just turned out to be the hamstring. So 2 to 4 weeks. So we breathe a sigh of relief on that one because we really need him. It was noticeable once he was no longer in the lineup, though they did still go on and score a bunch of runs. They're still hitting the holy crap out of the ball. But having that right-handed power, because right now, as far as right-handed power goes, it's kind of Adames and Contreras, and then it's, I guess, Ortiz has stepped into the breach there. But you wouldn't necessarily expect all of those things to continue. So, the Devin Williams thing, certainly read Kurt's article about this because it certainly was like they're like he's playing catch, but he's still saying end of July is what like is being targeted. So Murphy apparently made some comment like, yeah, we'd love to have him back, but apparently it's going to be a while. So I guess that's just the way that that's going to go. The DL Hall thing is very interesting because you feel like they really could use him in the rotation. I think that there's going to potentially be a need for him in the rotation by the time he could potentially be ramped up to go back to said rotation. But if they also just want to have him throw out of the bullpen, I think he can actually be really good there. As a starter, I don't expect him to be especially this year, anything more than like barely adequate. Whereas I think if you threw him, you know, one inning, maybe two innings, maybe, you know, keeping him to just one time through the order. So, you know, maybe facing six, seven, eight batters at a stretch, like, you know, vintage Josh Hader sort of stuff. That could be really, really good and useful for them. And he could really shine in that role. So it sort of comes down to, like, how badly do you feel the need and how badly do you just want to, like, get the best out of him possible?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's going to be a necessity call. I think they would love to have DL Hall in the bullpen if they had enough people step up into the starting lineup, the rotation to actually make it work. But, you know, we've had Bryce Wilson pitching there. I don't think that's been the plan. It's just they've needed people to take up innings, and I think Hall will go to there if they don't have a better option. But I think they would love to have him in the pen and not in the rotation at this point, because I think we've kind of seen what's there, and, you know, that they need a little bit of extra work to stretch him out if that's going to be a thing. But I think he's destined for the bullpen eventually, personally.
Yeah, it does seem the way that it's going long term for him, but for this year it feels like, yeah, they really could use it. Though I don't know, I was trying to find something and I couldn't find anything. Maybe you guys can find something about Jacob Junis, what's going on with him, because I feel like I heard something about him this week, but there didn't seem to be any proof of it online anywhere that I could dig up. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on with him. He is 60-day'd, so he's not eligible to come back until into June. So it'd be like a week or two into June that he would be eligible to come back. But that would really help too. Like if Junis could come back, I know he had started to work his way back after, because he went on originally with the shoulder scratchiness, which you never like to hear. That sounds terrible. And then took a foul ball to the head when he was in Pittsburgh, which seemed to slow everything down that way. So, yeah, he would really be useful. He was people forget, he was sort of a big part of their plan for rotation depth and to be able to get innings, either as a swing man, you know, in middle relief, or as a starter, or maybe a guy who is a starter following an opener sort of situation. What do they call those, followers? He would be really helpful too, but he just, you know, hasn't been healthy. We'll have to see. Also, Tobias Myers is going to be an important one to watch in AAA, because he seems destined to come back up and start, and he did show flashes of some good things. I mean, 17 strikeouts in 17 innings as a starter, that does get your attention from that perspective, but there were, you know, too many issues, six dingers right at the top of the list. So he's going to have to get better at not making the bad pitches that were leading to that sort of thing.
Absolutely. All right, let's pivot to the rest of the Patreon questions this week. So Steve S. is asking, two podcasts ago, I complained about Jake Bowers and he's gone off. Last time I asked about Sal and he had an exciting game. So who else can I fix? How about Owen Miller? Is there any hope that he can become a league average player?
No.
You know, Ryan and I were talking before we started and we're like, Steve, you really want to use this superpower on Owen Miller? What about like Churio, anybody else? But no, even with Steve's superpower.
Yeah, Owen Miller is just not good. He does not hit the ball hard enough. He can play some defensive positions, but doesn't, and he can't hit the ball hard. So no, that's not going to work. Like we could maybe charm another halfway decent like couple weeks out of Andrew Monasterio like last season. But you should be asking us to do Sal Frelick. Like that's what we should be using our powers to fix at this point. I know it was like a fun like 3 days, but it's not fixed yet. So we still need to keep calling him bad until he becomes actually good. That's the one.
Yeah, Steve was giving me, not Steve S, Steve G was giving me garbage about this. He's like, hey guys, because he listened to the podcast, I think, the morning after Sal hit his second home run in 2 days. And he's like, yeah, way to talk crap about Sal Frelick, because he's making you look
happy
stupid.
To help.
Like, yeah, that's you know, that's what we're here for, is the reverse jinx powers. But yeah, if you have this superpower, using it on Owen Miller seems like not the best direction to use it. I would direct it towards, yeah, say a Jackson Churio, who I posted this earlier this week. I was talking about this a little bit. And when I posted it, I don't know, was it Friday or whatever? Most of the responses that I was getting back to this were like Jackson Churio, which the problem with that is we have to then talk crap about Jackson Churio. And I'm just like, my heart wouldn't be in that. I can't talk crap about Jackson Churio. Like, I wouldn't believe the words coming out of my mouth. So, yeah, we're not at that point yet for him. So that's a tough one.
Just go full sports talk radio and be like, well, they gave him all this money and he's not producing. And forget about the fact that he's 20 years old. Yeah. I guess speaking of Jackson, Jay Google's asking, why did the Brewers keep pinch hitting for Churio late in games for guys who aren't good? It's perplexing. Paul, I feel like this is maybe the old timiness of Pat Murphy creeping through a little bit.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is a mixture of they trust old guys to have good at bats. I mean this in the old timiest way possible. There's probably also a little bit of wanting to protect Churio from high pressure situations, let him work his stuff out with a little bit less on the line so he can, you know, incorporate a proper approach at the plate and doesn't press and swing at bad pitches. Like, it's probably a combination of those two things, but this does strike me as an old man Murphy thing more than anything else.
So I don't know if you guys have caught up on Effectively Wild, but they had a really good discussion about Ron Washington this week and about some of the nonsense that Ronnie got up to. Have you guys heard that?
I have not.
Okay, so Ron Washington was calling for multiple suicide squeezes this week. And in
okay.
Yeah. And in a particular case, it was Daniel Giarte, I think I have or Luis Guillorme. Failed to get it down on a pitch that the pitcher was wild coming into the plate appearance, and he threw a pitch way outside that was on the suicide squeeze. I went and watched it. So the pitch is well outside. Guillorme goes out reaching for it to try to get the bunt down, knowing that the guy's coming from third base and he's going to be dead meat. And of course he doesn't get it, and the guy is dead meat. And after the game, Ron Washington lit up Guillorme for failing to get the bunt down and basically said the problem wasn't my call, it was his execution. And so Ben and Meg had an extended discussion on the idea that, like, sometimes managers start to think that, like, if they're not doing something, especially in a case like the Angels where they're once again free-falling and everything looks like crap because it's the Angels and everything they do turns to crap, that everything is going to free fall out. So managers get this feeling that they have to do stuff, right? They have to be active. They have to involve themselves in the game planning. And I think that there could be a little bit of that here, as you guys were saying with Churio. But this is where I want to point out that, like, if this is the extent of Pat Murphy's, like, over-management and him, like, trying to do too much and pull too many strings and whatever, I think we're kind of doing okay on that, because it could be a lot worse. See Ron Washington. Like, it could really be a lot worse. And yeah, we definitely don't want that. So as long as it stays to this sort of tinkering, where I'm assuming I'm most of the time off the top of my head, they're doing it to get a platoon advantage, I think is the thing. Somebody has brought in a right-hander and they're getting a platoon advantage on it. I don't think you want to see those sorts of things done long term, but short term, I think it's probably not that big a deal. You just don't want these things to persist.
I think I would agree, especially as he's still kind of adjusting to that massive learning curve, you know, between AAA or frankly, even AA, because he barely played in AAA in the majors. So, you know, if he gets pinch hit for late, you know, this year, probably fine. All right. Mark Podskarby, our next question, asking what's happened to the Brewers' elite defense? They're currently 20th in defensive runs saved. And specifically, I'm looking at guys like Joey Ortiz, Jackson Churio, and Sal Frelick, who are all billed as great defenders, yet currently have a negative defensive war, at least on Baseball Reference. So I guess, Ryan, is it just early season defensive metrics being wonky, or have you seen something that actually indicates some of those guys are at least struggling defensively?
So it sort of depends here. They don't have the DRS numbers up. I'm on the Fielding Bibles website right now. The Brewers were second behind only the Blue Jays last year, and it doesn't look like they have the numbers up for this year over on the Fielding Bible. I was trying to get a better feel for this. Yeah, there is definitely wonkiness in the early season numbers. And Willy Adames was taking like a hit on his early on, like the first few weeks, and we were going, oh, remember we had a discussion, is Willy Adames' defense slipping? And he's right back to kind of where you would expect right now. It looks like plus four over on Fangraphs, whereas he was negative just a few weeks ago. So I think that there is definitely early season noise in this stuff, and defensive stats do take a long time to normalize, but there have also just been some mistakes and some things where you go, there's just not as much crispness. Like, Jory Ortiz has made some throwing errors over at third that I don't think are going to be like a long-term problem for Ortiz, but I think he's still kind of, one, he hasn't played a ton of third base. He's been primarily a shortstop, so he's playing out of position a little bit, and also just, you know, he's in the big leagues. He's trying to impress. He's trying to, you know, guys sometimes just try to do too much. And I remember there was a play this week. I can't remember even which game it was, but like you could see Willy Adames, like as Ortiz was getting the ball and like releasing it, Willy was saying something along the lines of like, you have time or something, just to get him to like realize that he didn't have to like rip off a really fast throw to first base. So part of this too is just like you're betting in a bunch of younger players who don't have a ton of big league experience. So there's going to be some wonkiness in that too. I'm not overly concerned, but this definitely bears watching. I would expect them to climb up from what he was saying, 20th. I would expect to see climbing, but there's some things that here that bear watching.
Yeah. And defensive metrics are tricky. In small sample sizes, they're worse than offensive stats are. They do take longer to normalize. Prospectus actually likes the defense of Sal Frelick and Bryce Terang and Joey Ortiz quite well, by GRP anyway. Willy Adames is actually, I think, their worst defensive player on the Prospectus side. His range is down, according to them, quite a bit. But systems aren't necessarily agreeing on people yet. And I do think they'll be fine, mostly because they just have so much speed out there that they can't help but be at least average to slightly above average, almost by default. So I think they'll be fine defensively. They're also good at subbing guys in to get the best defensive lineup when they need to. And tactical defensive play is very important. So, you know, that's also a useful thing to keep in mind. It's early. It's defense in baseball. Don't pay too much attention to it until the All-Star break.
Yeah. Yep. We just got to be patient on this one.
Tricky Henderson, our next Patreon question this week, asking, our first place standing feels like smoke and mirrors to me, save the William Contreras experience. If it is, what will be the first trick revealed to the NL Central? If so, who exploits the crew? Please don't say Gregory Counselor. Or can smoke and mirrors win the NL Central? I kind of think so. Thanks, as always, for the words about Brewers baseball. So, Paul, I don't know. I felt like when the Brewers played the Cubs the first time, like these were clearly the first or best two teams in the NL Central I saw playing each other. But even then, the Cubs seemed kind of streaky. The Brewers obviously have their problems, as we mentioned. So how do you feel?
I don't really think smoke and mirrors is the way to describe it. Their offense has had a hot streak, but they have gotten a lot of good offensive performances from a lot of good offensive players. And it's not like their starting lineup had, like we could be saying, their starting rotation has been good, and it might fold soon because they might start to crack under the pressure. That's kind of already happened. So it's not something that can be exploited. Like, Freddy Peralta's gotten kind of beat up. Colin Ray's gotten kind of beat up. There's not something here you can, like, change your strategy to harp on. Maybe their bullpen will start to show a little more cracks than we've seen so far. That's one thing that could go wrong for them, sure. But you know, they have added Gasser, and they could actually get right on that side of the fence. So I think smoke and mirrors is the wrong way to describe it. I think more than anything, they've kind of had good cluster luck with getting good offensive output when they've struggled pitching wise. And if they're going to start to take some hits in terms of record, I think it would just be those starting not to line up as well. And, you know, losing some 6-2 games that they're currently winning 7-6, and, you know, winning some 10-0 games that they're currently winning 10-9, like that kind of thing. Getting out of whack is probably where they're most vulnerable. I don't think anybody can exploit them, Cubs included. I do think that they are the two best teams in the Central. The Brewers just are, we see exactly what they are. That's how they've played. And if things line up as they have, they'll still be good. It's just, it would be nice if they got something a little bit more under control, either on the pitching side, to actually have a more consistent output in terms of wins. That's where their vulnerability is. Like if they start to actually not score runs consistently when they're getting beat up, that's the problem.
So I think it's time to do it. We're on May 19th as we record this here. So I think it's time to pull out the playoff odds and take a look at those what do the systems say
all reference ones
about where these teams are. So I'm going to start with the one that has been more optimistic about the Brewers from spring training, and not ever before that. Like it had always been Pecota that was more optimistic about the Brewers, and this year it is Fangraphs, and that stays true to right now. Fangraphs currently, or I should say as of going into play on Sunday, had the Brewers with 86.2 projected wins and had the Cubs in second with 84.8. And then you have to dip down into the 70s, 78.4 for the Cardinals, and then the Pirates and Reds kind of bunched in there right behind them. So still very bunched. Top to bottom, they have them between 86.2 with the Brewers and 75.3 for the Reds. So bunched in pretty much, but they have the Brewers with about a 50-50 chance of winning the division. And about a 8% chance of clinching the bye, which that would really be something. I'm not expecting that at all. That sounds like crazy talk. But a 70.3% chance to make the playoffs, according to the Zips projections over, you know, the playoff odds powered by Zips over at Fangraphs. Switching over to Pecota, which, like I said, has been more suspicious of the Brewers this year. They have the Brewers currently at 85.7, which is 0.4 of a win behind the Chicago Cubs, who they have projected at 86.1. So they have them just kind of right there with the Cardinals and are giving them a playoff percentage of 64.5. So about 2 out of 3, a little bit worse, but not markedly so than what the Fangraphs odds were. And then, again, pretty bunched up between the Cubs at 86.1 down to the Pirates at 73.2. They give a little bit more credit to the Cardinals. They're expecting a little bit more of a bounce back. They have them at 80.8. So they have them kind of hovering there. And then Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, they actually do have down both below 75 wins. So they see a pretty big gap. They have Chicago and Milwaukee bunched together at the top. Fairly sizable gap St. Louis, fairly sizable gap Cincinnati and Pittsburgh together. So I would say overall, smoke and mirrors doesn't really work here. I agree with Paul that I don't think this is smoke and mirrors. They're outperforming what you would expect, I think, a little bit here. But I think these projections would also sort of indicate that the Cubs maybe are as well. They're bunched together and they're supposed to stay bunched with the Cubs, according to both of these. Both of these systems think the Brewers and the Cubs are kind of clearly out in front in the division, bunched up, and figure to stay kind of that way. And I can't really argue with that. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, it's sort of similar to last year, right? Where we were talking about this team and just banking a lot of wins early. And things slowed down in the middle summer months, but like you can't help but notice that the Brewers are doing well against a difficult schedule so far this year, and they're banking wins. And you know, it'll maybe largely come down to the head-to-head stuff over the Cubs, but you know, Ryan, you can't take away those wins that they have early on. Like, yeah, things are less than impressive right now, but they're still finding a way to squeak these things out.
Yeah, that's a really good point you bring up about the schedule, because honestly, the Brewers have faced a fairly strong schedule. I'm going to get into that in just a minute here. But have you guys been following how the Phillies have just played like the softest? Everybody's been kind of joking about the fact that the Phillies have played nobody so far this year.
Well, yeah, but also yeah. The East has been bad. The Marlins are horrible. Yeah.
Well, I've got some good news for you here on the Brewers for the rest of the year. If I'm reading this correctly, and I believe I am, the Brewers have the weakest strength of schedule in baseball for the rest of the season.
Huh, excellent.
It looks like they are 30th. Strength of schedule, yeah. Their remaining opponents have a collective winning percentage of 480. Tampa Bay is up at the top with a remaining strength of schedule of 532. So, yeah. Apparently the Brewers have the softest schedule remaining in baseball.
Nice.
So
that's got awesome.
A nice and little thing to put in your pocket.
Yeah, can't wait for Cubs fans to complain about that down the stretch as they're four games back of the Brewers.
Well, so the Cubs are at they're 24th, so they're not doing too bad themselves. Their opponents have a 491 winning percentage remaining. Cincy's 492. Where are the rest of the Central here? St. Louis 504 and. Who did I miss? Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's 498, so almost dead center. So, interesting. Very, very interesting. Yeah, the Brewers have really played a tough schedule and have done very well against it so far. So that's a nice little feather to have in your cap.
Absolutely. Even if Shota Imanaga is apparently the second coming of Fernando Valenzuela, as like everybody keeps trying to say, Ryan.
Sorry, it hurts. It physically hurts, especially now that we heard that the Brewers were interested. And that's a whole funny thing because I was not interested in Imanaga because enough of the analysts that I really like thought he was going to be a home run machine. And so I was just sort of expecting it to go that way. And man, he has been every bit as good as the Cubs could have possibly hoped. And he apparently picked them over us, so that sucks.
He just really wanted to live in Chicago and had Go Cubs Co. memorized, so there you go. Michael Parr, last Patreon question this week. Let's get this done before Paul falls asleep. Michael says, I live in Iowa. When am I going to get a legal option to watch the Brewers other than the occasional national game? The updates this week just seem to be slowing everything down. I guess the latest thing is a weekly game on Roku devices, which I don't think are actually subjected to blackout rules, which that's nice. But Paul, obviously, the broadcast deal's a big deal, especially when it comes to folks living in Iowa who are blacked out from like five or six teams.
It is six teams in Iowa. That's ridiculous. There, I don't think is a huge end in sight. The rights are going to get renegotiated, but the Iowa thing is ridiculous. Actually, last year, some Iowa politicians tried to pass a law that would outlaw blocking out games in Iowa, which I think is actually a good way to handle this. That is something that probably should happen, force their hand a little bit. But like, I don't know why baseball can't figure this out. I know TV contracts are all about exclusive territory and exclusive broadcast rights, but surely you can write into it that a territory can only have one or maybe two, you know, Cubs and White Sox, fine, yes. Mets and Yankees, fine, yes. But like, nobody seems to be able to figure this out or care enough about Iowa to actually do anything about it. So I think until things get portioned out a little bit more, and things get more granular in terms of paying directly for baseball, and home contracts aren't so punitive, that you're still going to be out of luck in Iowa for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised. Are you really not able to just get Bally's Wisconsin and watch that, like pay for that on a because it sounds like he's saying there's no way to do this. There's just no option to even do it. And I could have sworn that you could actually get Bally's, because I watch Bally's and I'll have the pay for the Bally's app and do that here. And I've watched on the Bally's app at my folks' place in Florida. So I'm not quite sure what the options are there. But what is coming here, obviously, like with the breakup of Bally's, with the Bally's going down in flames and going into bankruptcy, and it doesn't seem like it's going to happen this year, but there's something that's supposed to happen in, I think it was maybe August or September, where some of this might change then. MLB is getting ready to take over for those teams and start charging direct to consumer prices in home markets for teams like the Brewers, who are on Bally's and have their contract. We just don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But I think you should probably expect something later this summer, some movement on this later this summer, as going off of memory here. But I think there's something that's going to be happening relatively soon on that front. But yeah, the model here is changing. Paul's talked about this, like the model on this is changing, but people are still getting screwed. The Iowa thing is just so insane. And I feel bad about it, too, because far be it for me to ever say anything nice or wish anything good for the state of Iowa. But good Lord, like getting screwed on six Major League Baseball teams when you're in Iowa, it's that has always been the most bizarre thing in the world
to
me.
It's nonsensical.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things where if it happens, someone in the front office should be like, well, we have to stop that. That's ridiculous. Like, make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially because it's basically Cubs country, right? Like most of the people in Iowa are Cubs fans. So like everybody else shouldn't be blacked out. Like there's plenty of Cubs fans who live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or in Madison, Wisconsin, and the Cubs aren't blacked out in Milwaukee or Madison anymore. So what the hell are we doing blocking them out in Iowa, which is considerably further away and like not even in somebody else's home market? Like it's just stupid.
If you build it, you'll be blacked out. Yeah. I guess the second worst behind Iowa is Las Vegas, according to my very quick Googling research. They're blacked out from the Diamondbacks, Dodgers, Angels, A's, Padres, and Giants, even though like the closest teams are like 5 hours away. So like similar to Iowa, nobody's even really within realistic driving distance, but still blacked out from all of those games.
Utter insanity.
It's nuts.
Yeah. This TV thing is just, it can't end quick enough because it's just, what a mess for baseball.
Right. Especially when you consider like, fans will pay to watch the games. Like, let somebody in Iowa pay $20 a month to watch the Brewers if they want. I don't care. You know, like you're making money then.
Yeah. No, this is a shut up and take my money situation. And like the MLB is just like, nah. And I shouldn't pretend like I don't know. I know what this is about. I know this is about those high dollar contracts. I get it, but it's still so stupid.
Exactly. Rob Manfred apparently has said it's the league's highest priority to figure this out for 2025. So there you go. Take that for as you will. Maybe next year. We'll see. That'll do it for Patreon questions this week. Thank you, everybody. A reminder, patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month is all it takes to make sure your questions get answered here every single week. As we mentioned, Brewers continuing their longest road trip of the year. They're heading down to Miami to play the Marlins before wrapping up that 9-game, 10-day road trip in Boston at Fenway. And then it's Memorial Day week showdown with Craig Counsell and the Cubs. I will be there on Memorial Day, up close and in person to let Greg know how I feel. Me in 40,000 other people, I'm sure. But we will be back at some point in the next week, whether it's on our usual day or adjusted due to the holiday weekend. We'll talk about the rest of the Brewers road trip and how things are looking heading into June. Thank you for listening, everybody. Stay well, and we will see you here next time on The One.